and the loud blast, the blast that tears the sky, such thoughts to root from age
HeritageRadioNetwork.com. This is Burning Down the House with part two of our special Halloween dark satirical tale about murder, mayhem, suppression of architecture, and all those other creepy Halloween things. We were not able to complete it last week, so here is part two of The Black Prince. And I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. And we are brought to you this evening by Hearst Ranch. Since 1865, raised on 151,000 acres of Pacific Coast grassland, the finest grass-fed, grass-finished beef that you will find anywhere. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com. Thank you so much. Previously, in our recitation of The Black Prince, we've learned that the fairies requested of the new king, Carlos III of Greater Britannia, that modern architecture be suppressed. Summary floggings of modernist architects ensued. The revelation of his audiences with the fairy minister resulted in the firstborn son of Carlos, Winston, being appointed regent. But Eddie, the second son, and Carlos, the king, had another path in mind, and Winston became, alas, an historical figure, no longer living, breathing, nor regent. Eddie is about to step up to the throne. With that come royal prerogatives, and here we are in the cold and windy corridors of Burlingham Palace. Scene 18. The Widow Princess. Droit de seigneur, madame. Droit de seigneur. Moi, je parle français comme un vache espagnol. Ha, 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 ha. The prince was very drunk. There seemed to be no one in the vast and echoing corridors and suites of the palace. None save the Princess Royal, widow of Winston the Regent, Winky the Wanker, the dead prince, and the Black Prince. Je t'aime, Beatrice, je t'aime. Come here, you Hungarian wench. Come speak to the princely staff. Eddie was drunk and stoned, but not too drunk to have an erection, as the Princess Royal could plainly see. Mon sceptre, et voilà! Is pretty, no? It was a very dark and long night, but as her marriage to the late regent had been unconsummated, the Princess Royal did not overly protest. Scene 19. The Coronation. It is my desire, it is my command, it is my intention to maintain my royal name as Edvard, for I was named in the honor and memory of Edvard I, otherwise known as the Confessor, our last Anglo-Saxon king. We shall return to the glory of our Saxon heritage and commence a reconstruction of our traditional Anglo-Saxon values. And to mark this return to the spirit of the times before our ancestor Edvard I, I shall be known as King Edvard Zero, since, as everyone knows, Zero cometh before the One. Play now, play, sing! And the assembled choirs of Westminster, St. Botolph's Cathedral, and St. Bernard's in the Field stood all robed in red and white and black and sang Jerusalem. as the crowds in the streets and assembled multitudes on boats and ships in the river, Thebes, 100,000 on the embankment, all joined in. The stones of the abbey were well-nigh shaken as ruddy Anglo-Saxon cheeks burned with pride, as tears of emotion flowed. Britannia had a new king, and his name, forever and ever, would be known as Edvard Zero, King of Greater Britannia. The wags in the press were swift in dubbing their new monarch Edvard Naught, or Eddie Null. Eddie Null, no longer the Black Prince, now to be a radiant king, knelt before the most reverend and right honorable Archbishop of Canterbury of the Holy Church of England to receive his crown. Fireworks illuminated this foggy sky above Westminster, and Britannians everywhere were happy. At last, a king with verve, a strikingly beautiful man, his shock of ginger hair wild and Saxon-like above his black tunic, black jodhpurs, and shining black riding boots, beneath the ermine and scarlet cloak, beneath the jeweled crown of great antiquity. Eddie sprawled upon the Bishop of Londinium's throne in St. Botolph's Cathedral. "We bid you approach." A beauty, clad in a swirl of red moiré satin, a Balenciaga gown circa 1954, stepped slowly forward, a veil of red silk over her head. She parted her veil and spoke clearly, boldly, and the hall rang with her melodious voice, as if the call of a songbird, making the quiet of that cold stone forest ring with notes of joy. "I greet thee, O King Edvard," spoke Cheney McWilliams, "and bring you gladsome news from your former colonies of the far west." Cheney McWilliams, Eddie's college sweetheart, had been instructed in this ridiculous form of address by various footmen. She'd been given her pick of gowns from the historical costume collection of the Viviana and Albertus Museum. She had chosen well. "Approach us. Be seated, please." Cheney hesitated for a moment, then, gathering her skirts, she curtsied briefly, turned and seated herself at the right hand of King Edvard Zero, Defender of the Faith, Monarch of Britannia. "It is our desire, it is our command," and Eddie turned halfway in his chair towards Cheney, "to choose a mate, to select the fairest maid on the planet, to elevate her to our throne. I have chosen this fair maiden, whom you shall know henceforth as Queen Boadicea, so named for the memory and in the honor of the Celtic queen of Britannians, who slew, who defeated, who rallied our nation against the Roman legions in times long past but never forgotten. Let all pay her honor and glory. She shall become my bride on the morrow and be crowned our queen." The king rose, as did the assembly, stepping down from the dais, Cheney McWilliams of Bozeman, Montana, on his hand. Her skirts rustled as she stepped along, a dreamy and smug smile upon her weather-buffeted western face. The choir sang, the orchestra played, a wall of music issued forth. They played and again sang, "Jerusalem, the anthem of England." Eddie recited the lyrics in time with the choir. "It was the Holy Lamb of God, and England's pleasant pastures seen." And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? Was Jerusalem builded here? amongst those dark, satanic mills. It's Blake, you know, 1808, the best of his psychotic poems. Yes, Eddie, I know, I was an English major. But so were you, my lord, so were you. I do rather adore the verse about those dark, satanic mills. And it seemed a very long time ago that Cheney had first seen him in the library at Cambridge, and thought how fitting it was that a young man with such wild, unkempt hair should be reading William Blake in rapt concentration. So long ago that they were students together, it was that one image that inflamed her love for him. Scene 20. Progeny, or Who is the Real Queen? A footman intoned, "The Princess X, Royal Beatrice, is with child, Your Highness." "Oh, what joyous news! How splendid indeed! How advanced is Her Ex-Royalness's pregnancy? 1 month, sir." "Yes, good. How grand, how splendid. The king was in mood most merry, for the regent had died 1.5 months ago." The Britannish newscaster read the latest posting. "Mystery beauty conquers king's heart. Londinium, 15 April 25. King Edward unexpectedly proclaimed his choice of mate and queen in a surprise move during investiture ceremonies yesterday afternoon at Westminster Abbey. Royal household staff has refused to either confirm nor deny that the new queen, who is to be crowned today at St. Botolph's Cathedral, is an American named Cheney McWilliams, the only child of billionaire rancher Chuck McWilliams. If so, that makes the new Queen Boadicea, née McWilliams, one of the wealthiest women in America and by far the wealthiest woman in Britannia, surpassing even the king in net worth. It is known that as prince, King Edward attended a program in English literature in which the registrars have confirmed a Miss McWilliams was a student. So the extent of the king and queen's involvement prior to this surprising event remains a deep and tantalizing mystery." The news feed ended. Cheney put away her electronic pad. No news is always good news. The household staff bustled about, paying the queen little heed. Cheney preferred things this way anyhow. She was young, unused to having many servants, her life in the plains of home. She corrected herself. What had been her home was well attended by Autobots. Consuela, her only human housemaid, had demurred when offered a position at the castle. "Too bad," Cheney was talking to herself, "about Consuela getting cold feet. It would be nice to have a friendly face around, someone to cheer me up, someone who cared for me beyond the duties of being Eddie's consort. Ah, here we are, my beautiful queen." Today, Eddie was uniformed as an admiral, circa 1814. Wide hat and Wellington boots, the whole kit. Yesterday, it had been as a British fascist unit leader, a very walking, living, breathing royal impersonation of a Gauleiter. King Edward liked his costumes. It was a dangerous step to criticize the king's fashion whims, serious and fatal indeed. Cheney wiped her mouth of a crumb, rose, and bestowed a light kiss on both his cheeks. He smelled of cologne and hashish. Eddie liked the French double kiss protocol and had insisted that all members of the staff adopted it instead of a handshake. Eddie had scarcely been seated for 10 seconds when he leapt up from the table, exclaiming, "Hello, I have forgotten that today we shall greet Lieutenant Gaddafi. I must change my uniform. Sorry, dear. I'll see you at lunch, shan't I?" Scene 21. England and Libya embrace. The garden at El Bamaral had never been more festive, more grand, more carefully tended. Every blade of grass on the great lawn stood at attention. The flowers were especially verdant, and the hedges had been clipped to within a millimeter of orthogonal precision. Camels and donkeys had been brought into the garden. They lent a distinctly bizarre air, a sort of Jesus come to Scotland theme. But what really set the day apart was Lieutenant Gaddafi's splendid, vast, white silk tent, pitched in the center of the garden, guarded by female Gurkhas, red berets, mottled gray camo battle dress, submachine guns at port arms. Like his father before him, the Libyan ruler favored women bodyguards. King Edvard, seizing the opportunity to match, if not upstage, his guest's apparel, appeared at the great, well-polished, sparkling French doors in truly royal finery. Flanked by his own bodyguards, who carried freshly sharpened, glistening silver halberds, resplendent in white stockings, crimson velvet knee breeches, a matching red velvet codpiece, cerulean blue brocaded waistcoat, ample white silk shirt and neck stock, shimmering black silk greatcoat. He wore a wig that looked to be his own hair, ginger and slightly wavy, pulled back in a ponytail and tied with a black satin ribbon. His bodyguards were wearing uniform and kit last seen on Britannish soldiers during the American War of Rebellion. It was a stunning sight. Gaddafi emerged from his tent wearing a blue turban, velvet slippers, and a voluminous toga-like cloak that wound round and round his lithe, diminutive body. Gaddafi nodded towards the flap of the great tent, and together the two men strode off, leaving their bodyguards to form a double phalanx around the entrance. Not long after, standing in front of a hovering vidcam, King Edvard spoke to the world. "Leader Gaddafi and I have reached an historic accord today. The democratic Islamic State of Libya will repatriate as their own, without regard to original place or ancestral location of tribe, all remaining Islamic residents of Britannia. In return, Britannia will cease trading in oil from all other countries, relying solely upon the oil stocks provided by Libya. This amicable exchange will ensure financial security for all Libyans, native as well as resettled former Britannian, and at the same time, furthering the goals of that institution so dear to our heart, the Commission to Restore Britannia. It is a small matter, this pact. Thousands of Muslims have fled our country already, following the unfortunate York massacre and the regrettable ethnic cleansing of Yorkshire." Lieutenant Gaddafi smiled. The king smiled. Assembled staffs applauded, and that was that. The event was concluded. Scene 22. Later in the week. It was the last day of Lieutenant Gaddafi's visit to El Bamaral. Eddie was giving his guest a tour of the royal family's private rooms. "Here, look over here, Gaff. This is my bedchamber. Beyond there are the dressing rooms of Queen Boadicea. All very convenient, you see." Gaddafi said, "And over here, King, what is through these other doors?" "Oh, that!" King Edward's chest seemed to swell, puffing like a toad. "Through there are the private chambers of my brother's widow, the ex-royal Princess Beatrice of Hungary." Gaff was perplexed. I did not realize that you were a follower of the law of Jacob. Gaddafi meant the old tradition observed by Muslim and Mormon alike, encouraging the taking of many wives. Oh, yes, Gaff. Yes, it is my bounden duty to console the ex-royal princess as often as I have time, of course. Our duties are, like your own, very demanding. It was a wonderful time had by the two national leaders. Gaddafi sent Eddie a giant gilded oyster from the Bay of Tripoli as a talisman of fecundity, a thank-you present. Eddie, for his part, sent Gaff an autographed portrait of himself together with his newest concubine, the Vogue cover girl Hermione. They were together, naked, in the garden of El Bamaral. He had signed it, Adam. Scene 23, Birth of a Royal Heir. How pleased we are to welcome a new member to the household. Nice-looking little bastard, if I say so myself. Let us all put our hands together to praise Her Ex-Royal Highness's good fortune. Yes, well, the ex-royal princess sat quietly rocking, nursing her tiny son, saying not a word and ostentatiously avoiding any eye contact with Eddie. Queen Boadicea, herself 7 months pregnant, waddled into the room, a Springer Spaniel at her heels. She had been riding in the heath, and her jodhpurs bore a few refugee nettles. One of these stung through the twill of the pants as she sat, causing her to wince. Damned Scottish weeds. I'm so glad that you're getting lots of exercise, my queen. I am so very glad of your happiness and rousing good health. Emotions had run especially high between the king and queen since Cheney's first sight of the ex-royal princess's condition. And now the infant. It had Eddie's cleft chin, his ginger hair, and deep blue eyes. The shock Cheney first experienced had now subsided into a quiet loathing. For his part, Eddie was overly effusive now that his consoling of the ex-royal princess had become common knowledge. Other changes had occurred over the months. Once ignored by the staff, Cheney was now fawned over. The queen had earned a staunch loyalty from the royal staff. Have a scotch, Eddie, or smoke a joint. I think I like you better stoned or drunk or both. Where's my lady-in-waiting, Eddie? Have you been diddling her, too? Eddie, ignoring her jibes, said, Look there, it's the moronic Yankee president. The king did not look, but rather hoisted herself out of the chair, leaving alone in the room with the vid viewer. When she had gone, he lit up a joint and put his feet up on the sofa, silently watching the figure of the American president shaking hands with the prime imam of North America. This reminds me of my grand idea. It's time to set Ahmed in motion. Transfixed by the image of the president patting the imam on the back, both images wearing ludicrous grins, Eddie turned to his electronic pad and tapped a key to summon his aide-de-camp. Thank you. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host and reader this evening. This is not our usual burning down the house, although there are themes that have much to do with architecture, as we will presently learn. This is part two of The Black Prince, a satirical story of the abuses of power. Brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Since 1865, the Hearst family has been raising cattle on thousands and thousands of acres of Pacific coastal grassland range. The very finest grass-fed, grass-finished beef. Learn more about what the Hearst family is bringing to the world in terms of sustainable and delicious beef at HearstRanch.com. Thank you. And now we can continue with scene 24, the House of Lords. An enormous black Hispano-Suiza sedan, long and sparkling, purred to a stop within the porte cochere of the House of Lords. An attendant, uniformed in red velvet breeches, matching waistcoat, and a white powdered wig, smoothly opened the passenger door. The sight of a man dressed in costume of nearly 300 years vintage was no longer such an oddity. The fashion reforms promoted by King Edvard Zero had swept the nation. Even bartenders in the meanest local pub were again wearing knee breeches and wigs. So a 20th-century gasoline-fueled vehicle being attended by a servant in 18th-century livery was a new 21st-century reality. Out stepped the Saudi oil minister in complete Arab kit, flowing dishdasha, the traditional white desert robe, a checkered shema covering his head held in place by a black rope, the ogal. Only his gleaming, polished, bespoke shoes betrayed any Western influence. Close behind, similarly attired, stepped Ahmed, light as a wraith, silent as a butterfly. "It is my extreme pleasure," said a verger, "to introduce you to Lieutenant Gaddafi, Minister." The House of Lords was to debate the controversial royal pact that had excluded Saudi oil from Britannian import. And as if that were not enough to ponder, they were also to have a presentation from the director of the Royal Hydrogen Works. The oil minister attempted a smile. Instead, an unhappy wrinkle passed across his face, as if something unpleasant smelling had wafted in his direction. Ahmed hovered a pace behind the minister, now quietly humming to himself. The verger ignored Ahmed, continuing, "And here, Minister, is our own director of the Royal Hydrogen Works," waving his hands towards a thin, bespectacled man of perhaps 30 years of age. The director extended his hand. The minister did not take his hand, but rather gathered up the corners of his dishdasha. The Saudi minister grunted, "I must get to business. Let us address the lords without delay." "Yes, of course. Follow me." Great oaken doors swung open on silent hinges as the verger led the procession. At the front, the Saudi minister, with Ahmed just one pace behind. Lieutenant Gaddafi next, the hydrogen works director flanking him, pushing a trolley on which was a miniature maquette of the latest hydrogen-producing system developed by the works. Gaddafi was intrigued by the tinker toy.
"Does that work, director?"
"Oh, yes. Here, see the green emulsion. That is genetically modified algae. And over here, you see this furious bit of bubbling? That is our colorless, tasteless, delightful H2. The energy of the future! The source that is renewable and, well, I am so sorry, leader, will forever eliminate our dependence on your country's oil. And here, you see, we capture the hydrogen in these crystals?
It looks quite dangerous. I can imagine this process exploding at any moment.
Oh, no, not at all. Quite safe. 110% safe. As we like to say in the laboratory, we have extensively tested the process and this device, may I say. And as I shall demonstrate to the lords, it should be quite an interesting debate, leader. From a pram on the grounds, there came the sound of a baby's laughter. The Saudi crown prince Fazid, whom Eddie called Ahmed, heretofore quiet, save his idle humming, also broke out in laughter. His peals of glee rang through the hall. Not accidental, this outburst. Oh, no, for the Royal Institute had administered an unusually unhealthy dose of laudanum mixed with meth, a cocktail known to create great highs of manic behavior. It was infectious, this rolling laughter. And before long, the lords and ladies were all laughing. The director was holding himself in convulsions of laughter. The verger was laughing. Lieutenant Gaddafi was laughing. And even the oil minister was chuckling. Ahmed was laughing so hard that he was leaning on the trolley, laughing over the miniature hydrogen generator. He was, for one shining moment, truly happy. Where all Marines standing guard outside the hall heard that laughter echoing, reverberant, and wondered at the strangeness of it all. 100 voices, as if in an old English round. But thoughts of this oddity were immediately forgotten. The shards of the windows high above came raining down upon the soldiers. An orange fireball bellowed through the ragged casements, shaking the stones of the House of Lords, followed by great, greasy clouds of foul smoke, redolent of the stench of burned flesh. Scene 25, The World in Flames. The king watched a live vidfeed of the spectacle alone from his hunting lodge on the edge of the estate at El Bamaral. Yes, thought Eddie. Still more majestic shalt thou rise, more dreadful from each foreign stroke. As the blast that tears the sky, serves but to root the native oak. Rule Britannia, indeed, we shall rule the waves. Eddie turned off the vid viewer and stretched his arms, chuckling to himself, infected as well with Ahmed's final song of manic laughter. Oh, yes, my little beloved sand digger done himself all right in the end. Eddie put on a splendid greatcoat, adjusted a three-cornered hat on his head, admired himself in the mirror. His pigtail was shaping up to be quite beautiful, he thought. And the king took up his shotgun, whistled for his dogs, and set off onto the moor. Scene 26. Mood most lethal.
"We are most pleased," said Eddie at breakfast, addressing his nominative wife, Queen Boadicea. Niceties did not suffice these days. Things were becoming unhinged in the royal house of Winslow. "Finally, you have more guilt than I, Eddie," said the queen quietly.
"How dare you use a Yiddish word in this household? Really, Cheney, have you no shame? This reminds me that in addition to outlawing Arabic, we must add Yiddish to our list of proscribed runt tongues. Terrible, terrible of you. I know we have our misunderstandings, Janie, but really.
So now, Eddie, now you can afford to divorce me. I shan't be expensive to pension off. I'll take good care of your putative heir.
Well, it is traditional to accuse you of adultery and
have your head off. But, Cheney, I love you.
Oh, sure, Eddie. Me and a Hungarian and your cousin's ex and the Vogue girl. You, Your Highness, are pathetic.
Eddie lit a joint, poured a deep draught of scotch, and dismissed the morning staff, brooding alone in the breakfast room, as a delightful Scottish morning unfolded beyond the windows of the gray, brooding castle. Scene 27. Blowback. The news feeds were silent for a period of a few weeks, but when Queen Bee, as the news and blogosphere pundits had begun to call her, the ruler of the hive, the person with the upper hand, appeared at the Cannes Film Festival without King Edward Zero, well, it created quite a stir. Queen Bee had chosen to attend a premiere screening of His Workaday Whore, The Story of a Debauched Beauty, a thinly disguised fictionalization of Eddie's relationship with the Vogue cover girl. King Edward Zero was unaware, however, that his supposedly secret life was being ridiculed in such a public forum, for Eddie was lost in a miasma of marijuana, scotch, girls, women, fascist salutes, and costumery that varied by the day. For example, the thrill of knee breeches and wigs had given way to down-and-dirty fascist uniforms, soiled and smelly, redolent of imagined work in the trenches circa 1936, Spanish Civil War. And King Edward was the smelliest and most redolent of them all. Not that anyone mentioned, that would have been treasonous. Where are my cufflinks, Hermione? The king stumbled trouserless down the hallway, his khaki tunic unbuttoned. The guard at the door clicked his heels and gave the fascist straight-arm salute. The king staggered into the chambers of his concubine. She sprawled naked over the edge of the bed, a ruby necklace sparkling around her thin, fair neck, her much photographed breasts dangling, pendulous. Her famous flowing auburn hair was greasy and tangled. She had just vomited. A smear of her puke glistened on the ancient carpet.
I think, Eddie, that you put them up my ass.
Sneaking a glance at the girl, the guardsman smiled and closed the door. Scene 28. The Scarlet Letter. The death of King Carlos was no surprise. The funeral was a muted affair. Few bystanders gathered along the route of the cortege. Some removed their hats in respect. Others, scholarly-looking men and women holding rolls of blueprints, quietly booed as the royal hearse passed. At the cemetery, King Edward Zero held an impromptu press briefing. People of the world, I speak to you... excuse me. On this grave occasion, with sadness and respect for my father, our good King Carlos. In honor of my father and in honor of the valiant battle he fought against the untraditional and unsaxonly acts perpetrated by architects, especially modernist architects, we proclaim that his policies be resumed and renewed. Eddie had a personal stake in this beyond his need for a new crop of scapegoats for his playmate, the Vogue girl, had abruptly taken an overnight rocket to Buenos Aires with the renowned architect Manuel de la Venta, and the king was mightily displeased. The king would have his vengeance upon the entire profession. He was even weighing the possibility of launching a cruise missile to nuke Buenos Aires. England and Argentinium had a long-standing animosity going back a century or more to the time of Eddie's grandmother, Queen Mary Elizabeth. Perhaps he could start another war with Argentinium over the Folkestone Islands and accidentally take out Buenos Aires. That was a worthy thought. Some other day. Not only shall works of so-called modern architecture be forever banned in England, but all such works remaining in our kingdom that have not already been renovated or demolished shall be destroyed with all haste. And furthermore, because we have reason to distrust the Saxon purity in thought and deed amongst those in the universities and the professional associations which promote so-called architecture, the father and mother of all arts, and because these so-called modern architects have become as vipers in the garden of our kingdom, and because it is impossible to differentiate amongst the loyal Saxons amongst us in the architectural profession, we hereby order that all licensed architects within the realm shall wear upon their left breast, visible at all times, a white badge with the red capital letter A. A for architect. A for asinine. A for adulterous in their passion for forms and attitudes found to be an abomination unto the eyes of God. As spoke my dear departed father, our late King Carlos III. My people, pay heed to these villains. Mark their words, watch their actions. None of them is to be trusted. To the people, for the people. And he gave the fascist salute. Eddie was rather pleased with himself. Always an admirer of the Yankee writer Hawthorne, he had been pondering for years how best to use the Scarlet Letter, and had finally found a fitting and ingenious way to honor his father as well as the memory of his favorite novelist. Yes, the king was mightily pleased with himself. If the architect de la Venta ever dared set foot in his kingdom again, Eddie would personally flog him. Meanwhile, this new campaign against the weakest of professions would give the fascist union gang some new meat to chew on. Eddie smiled as he imagined de la Venta being beaten and castrated. Scene 29. A reunion quite royal. Let's have a reunion. I want to have all my children together with me. It will be gentle, sweet, festive, and wholesome, Cheney. Yes, yes, at El Bamaral, all of us together, all of us having a real, truly gentle, sweet, festive, wholesome time together, all of us. Finally, and forever. Eddie missed the Queen's emphasis on this one last point. His morphine fix was kicking in, and he had to lie down for a while. He muttered something vaguely pleasant. The great extended family reunion would be on Saturday, the 31st of October, Halloween. And Eddie was happy. So was Queen Boadicea. But for other reasons. Scene 29. And then the fairies spoke again. Jane McWilliams, Queen of England, had chosen as her queenly name that of a Celtic warrior woman who had fought bare-breasted, sword in each hand, who had led the Celts to victory over the Roman legions. The name Boadicea resonated with Cheney even more deeply. Like her eponymous warrior queen, her burning desire was simple. She would kill them all. Every last heir, every last pretender, any person of lineage, whosoever was tenuously linked to the monarchy, all of them, except her son, by Eddie, her dear little boy. Edvard I, dubbed version 2.0 by his drug-addled father, Eddie. Yes, little Prince Edvard I v 2.0. He alone would be spared. She was sitting by herself in the garden. The sweet-smelling summer, a faded memory. When the serious and beautiful fairy minister revealed herself amongst the roses. "Queen," shouted the fairy minister. "Oh, my God! Who the hell are you? What the hell are you?" Jenny almost fainted. This was weird. "Your Highness," the fairy minister, the same who had first spoken with the old king, as he was known amongst the fairies and elves, curtsied most courteously. Her gossamer gown glistened in the sunlight. "I thought Carlos had taken leave of his senses when he talked about, 'What are you, a fairy?'" Jenny was not sure if she was angry or should be frightened, but she surely was not happy to have her sanity tested. Not now, not on this day. There was too much to do. No time for losing it. "We are indeed, Highness. Fairies. English fairies, sir. French fairies are quite a different race." "So, what is this about? Am I dreaming? In which case, I would very much like to wake up." No one else was in the garden, so no mortal ears were disturbed by Janie's outcry. "Highness," the fairy minister curtsied again, "we come with glad tidings and words of high praise." "What the hell do you mean?" "We know your dreams, for dreams are a visible part of our natural landscape, and we know your heart's intent." Janie could feel her heartbeat coursing through her chest. She settled down on the lawn, cross-legged and slowly rocking to calm herself. "Highness, it will be all right." "How could you possibly know?" "As I say, Highness, we know all mortals' dreams. They are as visible to us as I am now to you." "So, okay, so what now?" "I bring you the news that we endorse you, we support you, and will, if we can, help you."
"And how is that?"
"So, you've come to tell me that you'll not interfere?"
Nay, in the dark of the night, which is our day, we will stand by you. We will ensure the deep and mortal sleep of all whom you will seek out on your mission this very night.
And then?
And ever after, for then we shall be the queens of the land, as it was in the old days when we were only chieftains among the mortals, for that is the natural state. And we, as creatures of nature, must seek equilibrium.
Well, then, I suppose I should thank you."
"Oh, no, Highness, it is we who thank you. And now I bid you adieu, for I know that you have myriad details to attend on this great dark day."
Again, and for a last time, the fairy minister curtsied. Her wings fluttered. She smiled. The sun went behind a cloud for a moment, darkening the garden, and she was gone. Queen Boadicea rose a little unstable and brushed the blades of grass from her skirt. She stared at the sky. She smelled the sweet nectar of the flowers and the breeze, and she sneezed. Tears came, but she wiped them away and turned to return to her chambers in the cold, gray house. Scene 30. Come on, people, now. Time to love one another right now. A military band, attired in the uniform of Royal Marines of the time of Queen Viviana, played on the lawn. Jugglers in harlequin silks danced on stilts. An elephant was dressed as a clown with the end of its trunk dyed red and great droopy white rings round its eyes and black and white spots painted on its hide. Queen Boadicea sat in the shade, a tepid gin and tonic, sweating little beads onto the marble tabletop. She bounced her son, Advert 1 V 2.0, on her knee in time to the beat of the military band. Eddie was a big fan of software, Micropath, the software giant, and of Bill Gritz, the billionaire software hacker, which accounted for the peculiar name that he had given his son. Cheney called her son simply Two. Things will be all right, Two. Eddie was resplendent in a robe and voluminous trousers he'd been given by Lieutenant Gaddafi. Crimson with golden edgings, a white silk turban on his head, his now well-grown-out pigtail dangling behind, with a scimitar sheathed and jaunty from a plated golden belt round his waist. To top off the effect, he wore blue velvet slippers with pointed ends that curled up into red pom-poms. He was doing magic tricks for the children, rubbing an Aladdin's lamp from which issued steamy holograms that displayed images of family trips upon which he had sent Queen Bee and the ex-royal princess with the children. The king never traveled with his extended family. Videographers recorded the scene in pornographically intense detail with many close-up shots of the beaming children, their mothers, their friends, smiles all around. And now began a medley of folk rock tunes from the 1960s, being played now by a pickup band comprised of the best rock musicians of the kingdom. Enough, it hurts my ears, said Cheney. Queen Bee, with no patience for this antique music, took Two inside for his afternoon nap. She lay down next to her son, cuddled him until he was fast asleep, and nodded off herself. Two women Royal Marines in ordinary battle fatigues, no costume, stood outside her chamber door at parade rest. There was a soft knock on the door. Drowsy, Cheney opened the door a crack. It was Sergeant Elizabeth, one of the Marines. Beg pardon, ma'am. A friend is here to see you. Cheney could see in the dim corridor the smiling face of her old housekeeper, a true friend indeed. Consuela, come all the way from home. Home, thought Cheney. Yes, that is home. This is not. Soon I will be gone, far away, back home where I belong. She opened the door further, laying a finger over her lips. Her son was still sleeping. Consuela, whispered the queen, hugging her friend ferociously. I came as soon as I got your message. Your father, he's very concerned. He sent me in the ranch airship. Good. I have everything prepared. Let's go into my dressing room for a moment. This is very grand, Miss Cheney. Consuela was awed at the sight of yards of closet filled with gowns, hundreds of pairs of shoes, several paste gem crowns. It's just stuff, Consuela. Just stuff. Scene 31, The Loyal Handmaiden. The Black Zeppelin rose from the grounds of the estate with only two passengers, Consuela and the infant Prince Edward I V2.0. In the comfortable darkness of the aircraft's gondola, Consuela felt safe and protected. She could see the horizon, lit by the glow of the descending sun, far away across miles of dark moor. Turning one last time to look at the somber castle that had been her friend's home, Consuela saw that fire was spreading across the roof. Windows were illuminated by an angry orange wall of flame, and she shuddered, shedding a brief tear. "May God help you in your hour of need, Miss Cheney," she mouthed as she admired the beautiful child asleep on her lap. Scene 32, The End of All Days. Queen Boadicea had prepared well. She had discovered a cache of military explosives in Eddie's hunting lodge. She'd been elated to discover amongst the stocks of ammunition phosphor-tipped rounds. Igniting the king's private stock of C6 would be child's play. First to go was the portion of the house housing the ex-Princess Royal of Hungary. It was a sad thing to exterminate a few lives who had done her no direct ill, but what had to be done had to be done. Cheney imagined she saw tiny figures flitting through the flames, feeding them just at the edges of vision. But no, that couldn't be possible. The apparition in the garden, the fairy minister, she had definitely concluded had been the result of some psychotropic drug that Eddie had slipped into her tea. The ex-princess's suite was in full conflagration. Satisfying work. But Eddie was nowhere to be found. Guardsmen rushed to quench the flames, but they were too late. Pocketing an automatic weapon, Cheney pushed in the opposite direction from the flames, running down the service corridors. In a secondary servery, Cheney found her husband, bare-assed, quite vigorously buggering one of the staff. It was a girl recently hired. Cheney didn't even know her name. Queen Boadicea withdrew the pistol. The girl caught a glimpse of the black instrument first, noticing the queen only secondarily as Cheney stepped around the door jamb in a crouch. "Bitch, you bitch! Sneaking on us!" she screamed. Cheney shot her once, clean between the eyes. The girl fell forward, leaving the king thrusting his member at open air. "Potty pooper," he drawled. "Yes, Eddie. Yes, I am." King is dead. Long live the king. She'd shot him twice in the chest. "No, you'd stop that track now, if you please. Thank you." She dropped a piece of C6 on Eddie's smoldering chest and fired, blowing him up. Cheney climbed into her Range Rover and calmly drove down the long lane heading for the motorway. She never looked back. There was nothing to see that she had not already seen. No last lingering farewells, no regrets, no doubts. Sergeant Elizabeth, one of the Royal Marines who had guarded her chamber, emerged from the shadows, raising her hands in surrender. Cheney said, "Get in." The Marine unholstered her sidearm, scanned the lawn, and climbed in. what was done had needed to be done. The Marine would protect the Queen come hell, inquests or angry royal remonstrations. She admired the Queen. She would serve her to the end of the world. Yes, ma'am. Shall I drive? I got things under control, Lizzie. The soldier looked far away towards the black horizon. There were figures illuminated by the headlights. Thousands of fairies, elves, trolls, and gremlins lined the lane, standing, crouching, hopping, flittering, paying witness and homage. They were applauding. "Ah, thank you, my friends," said Cheney quietly. Last scene, 20 years later. A young man stood atop a truck, his feet spread, arms akimbo. He held himself with a dignity that suggested great confidence. He wore a severe black tunic, tightly tailored trousers, and tall black riding boots. The dark cloth of his tunic set off a shock of lustrous auburn hair, worn long in the fashion of the times. At his side, a girl of about the same height, simple features, startling blue eyes, a pale and creamy complexion, a prototypical English country beauty. "My people, my folk," spoke the man, but he was interrupted by a middle-aged woman who now joined the couple. Her wardrobe was in striking contrast with the young man's black uniform, for she was dressed all in purple. Her posture suggested familiarity with the young man. She lifted a bishop's mitre to her head, standing erect and radiating a beatific energy. She made the sign of the cross over the assembled multitude, then turned to the couple. "With this crown and this orb, I, Cheney McWilliams, Archbishop of Canterbury and the Unified English and Roman Apostolic Catholic Church, and as Bishop of the Holy Province of England, by the power of God, in whose service all kings and chieftains shall rule, do anoint thee, Edward 1V2 Chief." The young man interrupted the woman as he spoke into a handheld microphone. "I was sired by the last monarch of our fair land. Despite the dark times of my father's cruel reign, you, the faithful, the justifiably proud, the free, never lost your faith, nor your hope. And you have, in the fullness of time, now called me to stand amongst you. I am proud to be counted as one of your own, though, as you know, my life has nearly entirely been lived in the western lands of North America. But I have heard your call, and I am here to serve you with gladness and single-mindedness of heart. With me is my partner, my better half, my fair lady Mary Elizabeth, also ready to serve you. I accept your gracious invitation, but sadly must say that I cannot be your chieftain, especially under the circumstances of the Archbishop's most unholy acquaintances." The young man knelt on the roof of the truck, and with him knelt the multitudes in the streets, on the sidewalks, on the rooftops and balconies. There was a hushed silence. What acquaintances? One of the young man's bodyguards, who had been standing at his side, eyes scanning the crowd, stepped between the Archbishop and the Prince. The guard spoke in Prince Tu's ear. Tu nodded with eagerness. Tu waved his mother, the Archbishop, away. "My people, we are a godly people, we, the folk of England.
And though it has been our heritage to believe in fairies and in elves, but you see, as godly people, we must not allow these things, these beliefs, these creatures to exist in our godly land. For you see, my folk, these creatures do exist. A convoy of trucks slid along the street that led to the square where two spoke. The people gathered along the route, shrank back, gasping and cowering. For atop the beds of the seemingly endless convoy of military trucks were structures containing every fairy, every elf, every troll, sprite, and nymph that had lived upon the godly land of England. The trucks formed a vast circle, and encircling them now were 100 jet engines mounted on wheeled carriages. You see before us the end of an era, my folk. These creatures have been with us, yes, and my daft grandfather wished them protected. But as a godly people, we cannot allow that. We cannot allow these creatures to infest our country. Prince's voice trailed off as 100 turbines spun up, afterburners ignited, and long, wicked, salacious flames played across the bodies of the anguished creatures. The fairy minister cried out, "You betrayed us, Boadicea! Your son tricked us! We curse you, mortals! With our death, you'll have no more magic! No!" The prince took the crown from his mother's hands and placed it on his own head. "Mother, to think that you conspired with these infernal creatures. Shame, mother, shame." Drawing a silver dagger from his boot, he slit his mother's throat. The flicker of the blade was so quick, so deft, that all that the crowd, already dazed by the inferno of the blazing metaphysical creatures, had noticed was that the archbishop had apparently fainted. "I am merciful, mother, most merciful. No need to suffer." King Tu knelt beside his mother, and taking a long black pistol from his other boot, he shot her through the heart. The end. Burning Down the House here on Heritage Radio Network. This is The Black Prince, brought to you by Hearst Ranch. Thank you for listening. This concludes our Halloween special. We'll speak with you again next week with talking about Henry Gifford and his class action lawsuit against the United States Green Building Council. That's a very exciting development. Let the music play.